Hey, everybody, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Preacher Boys podcast. I make this show for you, and I hope that you really enjoy it. I have a lot of people that ask me how they can support the show financially, and you can do that by heading over to patreon.com/preacherboys. You're going to get access to exclusive content, including early releases of episodes. I've got a couple episodes right now that have been released at least a month early over on Patreon. You've got access to things like unique merch, depending on what tier you join, and you get access to some behind the scenes content that I'm posting within the group. So head over to patreon.com/preacherboys and become a member over there today. Every single supporter helps make this show a little bit more possible, especially as I continue to add additional episodes and content every single week. Thank you so much for tuning in. Let's get back to the show.
Trigger warning. This podcast contains descriptions of various abusive situations. Listener discretion is advised.
I was in our 80th Police Basic Introductory course in Greensboro and became an officer, and it truly was one of the most amazing jobs I've ever had in my life. It taught me so much about myself. It taught me how to be a leader. It taught me how to confidently make decisions. And it also taught me that anyone can be a victim, as you said. I was in this relationship with actually another police officer, and I remember going from call to call to call. We had quite a lot of domestic calls where I was an officer. The most interesting part of that is at night when I would go home and take off my uniform, I was living in an abusive relationship with everything from physical abuse, emotional abuse, financial control, isolation, you name it. I was living it during that time.
You are listening to the Preacher Boys podcast, a podcast shedding light on decades of mental, physical, and sexual abuse within the independent fundamental Baptist movement. The testimonies shared on this podcast are told from the personal experience and perspective of the survivors. Not all legal outcomes are known or final. Any suspect is presumed innocent until proven guilty in the court of law. To find more information about the Preacher Boys podcast and upcoming documentary, visit PreacherBoysDoc.com or connect on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the handle @PreacherBoysDoc. Now, here is your host, Eric Skwarzynski.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Preacher Boys podcast. I am so excited to be sitting down with Claudia King today. This is a long time coming, and I'm really excited to get to welcome you on the show.
Thank you so much, Eric. I am really excited to be here. Yes, it is a long time coming. So thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. I know we met a while back. We were both taking this kind of online boot camp, trying to figure out how to get our voices and messages out there. And I mentioned to you during that time, I said, you need to start a podcast because you have a really interesting, powerful story. And I'm glad you have. So before we get into your story specifically, can you just tell me a little bit about your existing podcast and what the goal is?
Absolutely. So it's called Strong Enough Podcast. And I decided on the title because I wanted people to understand that they truly are strong enough for whatever it is they're facing in that moment, because we're all facing something. And the podcast really focuses on relationship wellness. Now, that can be a romantic relationship, friendships, family relationships. You know, I think we've all been through situations where we have issues with each of those types of relationships, and we're all wondering how to maintain them and how to keep them happy and healthy. So sometimes I focus people who have been through a trauma and want to talk about getting through that. But then sometimes I have guests who are just in a really awesome relationship, and I want them to share how they do that and how they succeed so that those things can be inspirational for other people.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I love the concept of being strong enough, because I think there is a misconception, specifically dealing with domestic violence or abuse, which is things that we both cover very often on our show. I think there's a misconception that, you know, weak people get involved in these situations or find themselves in unthinkable circumstances. And one thing that I love about your story and about the things that you communicate is that this happens to everybody. Like there's not a common victim, for lack of a better word. There's not a certain brand of person that gets preyed on. Like, these situations can happen to anybody. And the, regardless of how strong you are or how, you know, quote unquote weak you are, which I don't think many people could really be labeled as such. Mm-hmm. You know, these things can happen, and you do have the resources to pull yourself out of it and to really battle these situations head on. And I really do commend your show for really pushing that message.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
Absolutely. As far as your specific story, I do want to go back and kind of give some context for you, because you've got a really interesting story. And like I said, you know, what startled me when I first heard your story was, you know, like I said, we do have this misconception that people who get involved in situations of domestic violence are, you know, they're weak or they're easily manipulated or they have traits that make themselves vulnerable to, whether it's a cultish group or whether it's an abusive partner. You know, it's something about them. And the reality is you can be a very strong person. And what's interesting about your story is you actually were a police officer, and that is the last person you would imagine finding themselves in a domestic violence relationship. Like, it's hard to wrap your mind around that. Can you talk, as much as you're comfortable sharing, mm-hmm. can you talk a little bit about, really what inspired you to be a police officer, first of all, and then how simultaneously you're working with victims of domestic violence while also being a victim of domestic violence at the same time?
Yeah, absolutely. So I wanted to become a police officer initially because I wanted to be a detective. And when I was little, probably about from the age of 5, I wanted to be a detective. And then when I grew up, I sadly learned that detectives were actually police officers. So I had to change my course a little bit and say, oh, I guess I want to be a police officer so I can become a detective. So I, you know, went to school, graduated from school, and it was actually shortly after 9/11. It was that year that I applied, and I just kind of said, you know what am I waiting for? I should just do this. I should just try and see if I make it. So I put in my application to a department in North Carolina, a fairly large department that actually runs their own academy. So like, I didn't have to go to an academy beforehand. I was thinking fiscally as well, because I would get paid to go through the academy. And I just thought I'd give it a try. And I was accepted into that. I was in our 80th Police Basic Introductory Course in Greensboro and became an officer. And it truly was one of the most amazing jobs I've ever had in my life. It taught me so much about myself. It taught me how to be a leader. It taught me how to confidently make decisions. And it also taught me that anyone can be a victim. As you said, I was in this relationship with actually another police officer. And I remember going from call to call to call. We had quite a lot of domestic calls where I was an officer, and I would get really upset with these individuals. And typically they were women, so I'll probably say she or her a fair amount, but I would get really genuinely upset with these people and say, not to them, but, you know, to myself or later, what is wrong with them? Why don't they care more about themselves? Why are they doing this to themselves? And I even would joke, and this is really embarrassing to say now, but I would joke that victims of domestic abuse who were repeated victims should be charged with aiding and abetting, because they were aiding and abetting the abuse by not leaving. And I really thought that, you know, I truly believed that. And the most interesting part of that is at night when I would go home and take off my uniform, I was living in an abusive relationship with everything from physical abuse, emotional abuse, financial control, isolation, you name it. I was living it during that time.
Did you recognize what you were experiencing as abuse, or was it something where you were deflecting all of that onto the people you're dealing with day to day? Like, or was it something where you did understand it and there was this kind of shame that you were feeling where you felt like, okay, I know I'm going through this, but the way that I'm going to cope with it is by focusing on other people's situations.
I think as time went by, it was all of those things. I think initially I just thought he sucked, you know, as a boyfriend, and it just wasn't that great. But at the same time, I didn't really deserve any better. So I'm just going to deal with it. It's fine. You know, he's really not that bad. These are all the things I would tell myself. So I think I was really deflecting it a lot onto the other victims that I was dealing with, because I wasn't ready to accept it myself. And then when I finally did accept it, and that took a long time. I mean, we were together, I think 2-3 years, and we lived together. But once I decided, like, yeah, this is not okay. This is something that I should not be involved in. Then I was able to really see him for what he really was and start to see all the different actions as abuse.
We're speaking to your perspective as somebody who experienced abuse within a position where, I mean, of all people, police officer, well put together, mm-hmm. educated, like strong, tough, you know, and dealing with these cases. But I do want to also turn this, because one of the things we talk about are power dynamics mm-hmm. within churches usually, but within abusive relationships, there's power dynamics. And I'm always interested by people who are able to get into positions of power, whether it be a police officer, a pastor, you know, different positions like this. When you look back at this relationship, do you ever wonder why no one else saw red flags? Like people who were in law enforcement, who were working with this person day in, day out, who were seeing his personality and his tone, like, you know, and obviously there's a big conversation nationally about police officers and, you know, aggression and all these different, you know, what should we be able to spot? Was he a chameleon, or was it something where like someone should have seen this and stepped in and tried to assist?
That's a fantastic question. And I think there were those red flags. Obviously, there were those amongst my family and friends who saw him, you know, more often that I ignored. But yeah, there were actually other officers and command staff who saw some things that probably should have alerted them to more. He actually ended up losing his job, and I don't know if he was fired or allowed to resign, but he lost his job there for falsifying reports. So there was a pattern of him lying. There was a pattern of him taking equipment when he shouldn't have. So maybe things that weren't directly related to abuse per se, but things that certainly should have given people pause and reason to ask more questions and dig a little deeper.
Why do you think people don't tend to ask questions in situations like that? Do you think it's purely just because it's an uncomfortable conversation? Or do you think it's a lack of understanding and resources relating to how to identify these red flags?
I think it's probably a little of both. You know, I think we still generally, so many of us have that standpoint of, I just don't want to get involved. It's none of my business. And so it's easier just to back away and not ask the questions, because once we start asking them, then we start to get the answers. And now what do I do? You know, now I'm presented with these answers that now I have to take action. And so I think it can be a domino effect that if people don't ask, well, then they don't have to deal with it. But I think it is also the inability to recognize these red flags. That's one of the things that I'm working more on, both with my podcast, but also in my day-to-day work at a nonprofit, is really educating people about potential red flags. And yes, one thing or two things, it may just be a coincidence. But when we start to see things adding up and people doing things that just don't always make sense, we need to ask more questions, and we owe it to ourselves and we owe it to the people involved to dig deeper.
Right. Well, pulling back into your perspective in this situation, because you're somebody who's sitting there, you know, you're going out, you're looking at other people, you're seeing clearly the red flags and what they should be doing. But I have to ask for your perspective, and for so many people that find themselves in these situations, why do you think people stay in these environments? Because there's many, many people who have been in domestic violence relationship after domestic violence relationship. They've stayed within one where it's abusive for many, many years, even though friends and family may have stepped in and said, you should leave. What was maybe your reason for staying? And what do you see similar patterns within other relationships?
I definitely do. And you're right, because my family and the friends I was allowed to keep around said the same thing. You know, what are you doing? Why are you staying in this? First off, that's part of the problem. We never want to ask why questions, because that only made me feel worse and it put me on the defensive. So now I'm in a position where, well, I have to defend myself. And in defending myself, I end up defending this guy as well. So I think that's a big part of it, is we want to prevent that shame and we want to prevent that defensiveness. I think the reason that people stay in one relationship or kind of bounce, as you mentioned, through a cycle of different abusive relationships is because we constantly are getting torn down. So that's part of what an abuser does. And that can be part of the grooming process that you and I spoke about earlier, is we as victims are constantly told we're not worth it. You don't deserve anything else. You're not that pretty. I mean, you're lucky you have me. These are all things that I used to hear. You know, you're lucky I put up with you. What would you do without me? And so when you constantly hear these things over and over and over again, you really do start to believe them. And so I feel like for me, you know, when I put that uniform on, I was a different person. I was that officer. You know, it was almost like putting on my superhero cape, because I was able to then go out and help people and make a difference where I couldn't even do that at home.
What are some of these red flags? So we should probably identify them before we move along, because I do want to talk about actually leaving these. But when we talk about red flags, it's easy to say, hey, there were a lot of red flags, or it's easy to say in hindsight, oh, I saw this. What are some of the key things people should be looking for when they see someone that's off? Like, how do you identify the difference between, hey, they had a bad day, to this is a pattern of abusive behavior?
So when you're looking at these red flags, you want to look for that pattern. So it can be anything from the demeaning language, you know, telling people they're not worth it, getting angry really easily, yelling all the time, putting somebody down, using their sexual past against them. You know, well, you did this and that with him and that other guy, why won't you do it with me? You know, making you feel bad about decisions that you made before. It can be financial things. So, you know what? I don't want you to work. I don't want you to have to worry about that. I'll work, so I'll take care of all the money. Or, you know, you're not smart enough to handle our bank account. Let me do it. So again, you're breaking the person down and in the same time, taking more control. So I would say if you're looking generally for red flags, and it's easy to talk about physical abuse, right? That's the one that we can see, or that leaves generally some type of mark or soreness or, you know, a bruise, a broken bone. But really where the red flags come into play is the things that we can't see. So it is about listening. You know, if you have a friend who talks about her boyfriend that gets really angry all the time, or he got mad and he threw something and broke something, you know, you're right. Somebody can get angry and that can happen. But if we're seeing this again and again, or if we're seeing he threw my phone and broke it, well, in Colorado, that's actually a domestic violence crime. If you're in a domestic violence relationship, if you destroy somebody else's property for punishment or retaliation, you can be charged for that. So these are the things that we need to start looking for that, yeah, it doesn't seem like such a big deal that her boyfriend smashed the glass and cut something, but it really is. And those are the things that we need to look for and see, is there a pattern? Is she afraid of him? Does she think worse things can happen?
You obviously mentioned, which I think is fantastic advice, is don't ask why. Like, why are you in this relationship? Because you are putting them on the defensive. What's the proper way to approach somebody? One, maybe with just a concern initially, but even going deeper than that, how do you approach somebody who is stuck in this pattern where you need to maybe employ some tough love or really shake them out of this situation? Say, like, you need to recognize this is dangerous. Like, this could lead to you being hurt or worse. How do you begin that conversation with a friend or a loved one?
So I think the way to begin that conversation is by asking, is everything okay? Is everything okay in your relationship? Are you doing okay? You know, how are you guys handling the stress right now? Some very innocuous questions that really can lead to a deeper conversation. But one thing that we realize in dealing with victims of abuse is that we can't make anybody do anything that they aren't ready to do. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we say is, I can't define success for anyone else. So I can't define what would be a successful outcome for you in your relationship. All I can do is provide you the resources. So I would say, you know, just ask a couple questions. Again, not the why questions, mm-hmm. but are you okay? Do you need anything from me? And maybe, you know, take what their answers are, give them some time to really think about it. Don't fire questions away. Ask the question and let it sit out there. Sometimes that's the hardest thing to do, right? Is just to say, are you okay? And then just stare at the other person. But that's what you need to do. Let them talk, let them open up and take clues from what they're saying. But in the end, you can't force them. Now, I would say when you said tough love, you know, probably the couple things that you could do that are similar to tough love is you could show them what's called a power and control wheel. So that's easily accessible on the internet. If you just type in power and control wheel, you'll get a lot of pretty images and some just black and white ones, but it really defines the different types of abuse and it gives examples of what people might be experiencing. Mm. So like we talked about earlier with the minimizing and denial. So it's easy to say, no, it's not that bad. Like he just yells at me sometimes. But when you can show people that wheel and start to ask them questions or let them look at it themselves and say, well, are you experiencing this emotional abuse? Does he do this? Does he do that? Does he call you names? Does he belittle you? Does he not give you money? Does he make you ask for money? Does he hit you? You know, when you can look at that wheel and start asking those questions, that's when people can really start to realize, oh, okay, I'm seeing it in black and white. This is something. The other one is called a threat assessment. Those are a little more difficult to find on the internet, but you can find them if you just look up threat assessment and you'll see a couple different versions. But it's a way that you can present questions to the victim to determine what level of danger or threat that they're currently in. So for example, it's going to ask you, you know, is the abuse intensifying? Has it intensified in the last year? Is the abuser using drugs or alcohol? You know, are they financially controlling you? There's going to be different questions they're going to ask. And at the end is a literal score of, you know, anything from it's not so bad right now to probably the next time I see you, you're going to be dead. And I want to be that blunt because this is the one moment where you want to be that blunt with the victim and say, no, look, this says you're probably going to be dead soon. And you want them to take that in. But again, if they choose to go back, we have to accept that. And we have to know we gave them the resources that we could.
Right. I think for a lot of people who find themselves in these situations, there is also that, where do I go from here? Like you mentioned, when there's financial control, when there's emotional control, you're not worthy, when there's all these different things. And you're basically manipulated. I don't want to use the term brainwashed because I think that term, the more I read and the more that I listen to experts talk about, that word is rarely used now because I think it's too reductive of what is actually happening. But when your thought processes change completely to fit the narrative that's being told to you, it can be very difficult to imagine surviving without them. There's that security of the familiar, you know, that people stay in. Mm-hmm. For somebody who's sitting there and is going, okay, I'm in a domestic violence relationship. I know that. I know that I am probably going to be seriously injured soon, or I know that maybe my children will be, or something bad is going to happen. But what am I supposed to do? Where am I supposed to go? How do I get an apartment? Now, all those kind of things. What are the first steps somebody should take to safely exit a domestic violence relationship?
Great question. So I would say first and foremost, if you are in imminent danger or your children are, please call 911. Now, I know there are a lot of reasons that a lot of people don't want to contact law enforcement. So the agency where I work, we only get about 14% of our referrals from law enforcement. So that means 86% of our clients don't want anything to do with them. And that's okay as far as we're concerned. So I would say one of the first steps is to determine who is your support system. So who can you call in this moment of crisis? Who can you trust? Now, for some people, the answer is going to be no one. I don't have anyone anymore except for the abuser. And that's okay too. That's why organizations like mine exist. So I can't speak for every other nonprofit that supports victims of domestic abuse in the country. But what I can tell you about ours is that we're there 24/7. So you can call us anytime. We can help with financial assistance. We can help you with finding a place to live. We can help you getting your kids back in school. We can give you clothes and food. So we exist to pull down those barriers that prevent a lot of people from leaving. What you asked though about, you know, what should people do if they're ready to leave? First off, they do need to recognize that that's generally the most dangerous time is when you leave. That is when victims are at the highest risk of being killed or seriously injured. So it is important to recognize that. And it's important to have a plan. So have a place to go where this person doesn't know. Consider getting rid of your cell phone, or at least taking out the SIM card or turning it off in case they're tracking you with that method. Only tell trusted people where you're going. There are things like the address confidentiality program where people can actually give a fake address and have their mail sent to them. Essentially, it's a lot bigger than that, but that's the basics of it. So I would say to recognize the danger that you're in and act accordingly.
Now, are there any times you'd recommend not contacting law enforcement? And the clarity I want to give to that question is, I know for a lot of people who are in especially threatening situations, the concern is police come out, the guy sweet talks his way out of them, you know, being there, or you're in a situation where, you know, for whatever reason, they can't arrest him or fill in the blank, whatever happens, the police leave, your situation just got a lot worse because you just called the police. Is there some step that should be taken before contacting the police? Is there ever a situation where it's not wise to call them out to a certain situation? Like, what would you recommend to people who are scared of that scenario specifically?
So this is a hard one for me because, of course, being former law enforcement, you know, I want to believe that the police can help everybody and they're always there to save the day. But we know that's not always true, particularly people who have immigration status issues. You know, they're very hesitant often to call the police. But like you said, more so is victims are afraid that if the police come, and it is, you know, often that the abuser can sweet talk his way out of it, turn the tables, do something, and then the situation is far worse. So, you know, I don't want to give people the advice of whether or not to make that call. I want to say, if you are in imminent or immediate danger, call 911. It's just the best thing in that moment. But if you're not in immediate danger, you can always call your local advocacy organization. So our number, just for everybody out there, is 970-668-3906. Now, while we can't help everybody all across the country, we can help find resources in your area. So if that's the only number that you can remember, remember that number and call us, and we'll help you find somebody locally. But I think the best answer would be to at least reach out to an advocacy organization and find out what your options are. Sometimes we're a lot more courageous in the steps that we take when we have the confidence and the knowledge of what's going to happen. So obviously, we can't make any promises, but we can at least tell you what the potential steps are that you can take, what actions you can take to protect yourself, and how you can most safely get out of that situation. So don't suffer in silence. call us or call a local organization and at least talk through the possible steps.
And I'm glad you clarify that. Like, I think imminent danger, definitely call 911. Like, don't risk, you know, trying to evaluate or assess the situation, but specifically to those situations where maybe they're not in imminent danger, but you know, maybe that's it is a rising situation or it's escalating really quickly, but they may not have something, you know, concrete to point to. Mm-hmm. I think that's a really good piece of advice. I am curious, and the reason I'm asking some of these about law enforcement is obviously your law enforcement background. And I know, obviously, like I said, there's a lot of national conversation happening. I think that there's not a lot of helpful discourse about law enforcement and force and all those different conversations. But I am curious, from your perspective as somebody who obviously still loves law enforcement, you spend a lot of time in it, serving in it. When you look at how the law handles these cases, what are some areas you think there could be some improvement? And, you know, what are some ways that you think that law enforcement could better assist victims who are in these situations?
That is a great question. You know, I really think better understanding the cycle of abuse is a great start. I know, you know, when I went through the academy, yeah, we did a whole section on domestic violence and we talked about how those are some of the very most dangerous calls for us as law enforcement to go to, because a lot of times there are weapons, they're very heated emotionally. So it can be very dangerous for officers as well. But we never really spent time digging into what made that situation and what makes it occur over and over again. Mm-hmm. So I really think education is a great first step, because when you don't understand something, it is sometimes hard to help. I think really focusing on who is the abuser and who is the victim is important, because there are cases where, like we discussed, that an abuser can manipulate the situation. You know, he can get the victim to maybe hit him back, but then now he's the only one with a mark. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of states that legally, if somebody has a mark and somebody has said they were struck, the law enforcement personnel must arrest. So it's not a coulda, woulda, shoulda. This is the one area where they've taken out a lot of the guesswork and taken out your ability as an officer to make a decision, you know, really, and decide, well, I'm just going to let them go with a warning. So when it comes to domestic violence, that's not always the case. They have to make that arrest, which is great in one aspect, because a lot of times victims are afraid to say what happened, but if they're standing there with a black eye and say they got hit, there is going to be an arrest made. But it can also turn the tables in a way that doesn't turn out so well. So I would say education, and then asking more questions, digging deeper, you know, looking in your CAD system before you go to the call to see if there have been previous calls to this address. Maybe if you have time, pulling up some of those reports of what happened at that right. previous address, so you have a better understanding of the dynamic before you even walk in there.
Context is so important. And mm-hmm. I just had someone on my show a few weeks ago, and, you know, she had that situation in a courtroom setting where she, all of a sudden, there's a new judge looking it over. He looked over her case for about 10 minutes and made a couple statements and remarks about some that really made her upset and made everybody who was watching upset, because he was making statements kind of almost bringing down the legitimacy of the issue, because he didn't have any context for the relationship that had happened, for the level of abuse that was happening. And I think in all of these things, you've said this time and time again, whether you're someone who's trying to assist a friend, whether you're law enforcement, whether you're a leader, like, you have to ask questions and get to know the story, because just going off of one instance is not going to paint the full picture for you. And I really wanted to get your perspective on that, because I know even people that listen to this show, there are some mixed feelings about the legal system, mm-hmm. about law enforcement. There's people who've called and have had, you know, the ball in their mind dropped. But I also know, talking to people like you, I've had, you know, some other former law enforcement, current law enforcement on the show. There's frustration on that end too, going like, we don't have the resources to really address these situations the way that we should. I want to ask one last angle just as far as leaving, because this also makes these very difficult, is, you know, we mentioned children being in the home. For somebody listening who, again, knows, okay, I can leave, what do I do with my kids? You know, it adds another layer to this. Would you recommend similar steps for them, reaching out to an advocacy group, or would you recommend any nuance to how they address that situation?
I would recommend pretty much the same thing. So again, in our shelter, we accept children, we accept pets as well, mm-hmm. because for a lot of people, those are their children. And we know that about 50% of victims with pets will delay leaving because they don't want to leave their pet behind. Mm. So I would say with children and pets, pretty much the same thing. You know, you want to make sure, again, that they are first and foremost protected. You know, you don't want to necessarily tell your kids everything that's going on, because depending on their age, that might be a lot for them to handle, but you may want to give them a little bit of information, like, hey, you know, if daddy starts yelling again, you should go to the neighbor's house. Mm. Or, you know, if I say some code word, you should call 911 and teach them how to do that. You know, if you feel like it's going to be a dangerous situation, do what you can to get the kids out of the home if possible and send them to somewhere that they can get help. It's also really important to practice those things. So it's easy when you're sitting there to say, oh, okay, you know, I'll tell little Bobby to run to the neighbor's house. And then you tell him, little Bobby, if dad starts yelling, run to the neighbor's house. And little Bobby's going to say, cool, I got it. But in the heat of the moment, little Bobby may not have it. So same with adults, you know, sometimes we freeze. So it's really important to actually practice these things. So if you're going to tell your kid to go get in the car and buckle themselves in, well, let's practice that a few times. Let's say, here's the code word, and have the child actually run and get in the car and buckle themselves in. And then you come out to the car, or let's have you find your keys and run out to the car and click the unlock button. Cause we've all seen in the horror movies, you know, fumbling with keys, and it's funny, but it's true. You know, that's a time when we're so nervous that we can fumble and we can't focus on those small dexterity movements that we need to act. So it's very important to practice those things. And if you have kids, have them practice as well.
Is there any legality thing with leaving? Because I think that's another thing too, is like, again, that's something can be turned. Oh, they took the kid and they left. And, you know, is there any legal thing that people should be aware of before making that decision to leave and go to a shelter, you know, unannounced, or slip out in the middle of the night with a child? Is there anything there that they should be aware of that could be used against them later on in a court proceeding or in any kind of legal avenue?
I think it's really important for them to document their actions and why they took those actions. So I don't want to speak about civil law for a couple of reasons. A, I'm not a lawyer. And then I'm not super well versed in civil law. But I do know that when it comes to custody, that's a civil matter, generally speaking. So what you would want to do is document your actions and why you took them. So I would say, if you do have kids, it would be really important to pretty quickly contact your local advocacy agency and explain this to them, because they can often put you in touch with an attorney. For us on staff, we actually have an attorney on staff who can kind of talk through that with you and tell you what the steps are to gaining custody or to even getting a protection order. So if you can get a protection order and then have reason to have your kids on that protection order as well against the abuser, well, that's just going to strengthen your case for custody. Yeah. So I would recommend keeping a record, documenting why you did something, and then getting that noted pretty quickly from an outside source. So right. Talking to the police, if that's who you want to talk to, getting that report, even if they don't make an arrest, they'll still write a report. So now that report's going to be in the system. Talking to the agency saying, this is why I took my kids. I was in fear of XYZ. So now you have it documented from outside sources. And I think that's really key.
Yeah. I want to echo something that was said probably a year ago now on the show by another person who does similar work to what you do. And you know, the issue of protection orders came up. And I do want to repeat what he said, because I think it's important to realize, one, and I think most people probably know this, but it's not a magical shield that's going to protect you from any violence. People violate protection orders. Like, that is reality. But what you just said, I want to just double down on, for people that are disenfranchised with maybe law enforcement or are still go through the steps of getting protection orders, go through the steps of getting all that for the reason that you just mentioned, which is it's a paper trail showing that you've taken steps and that they violated those steps. Mm-hmm. If somebody violates a protection order, it's, again, it's not going to protect you maybe physically, like the way that you would hope a document like that would. But at the time they violate a protection order, it's going to bring a lot more heat toward them in the legal system for doing that. Like, it's going to add more validity to your case, mm-hmm. and it's going to give the judge a lot more leverage to really bring the hammer down on somebody like that. So please, again, whatever, I understand being cautious with a lot of things, but please go through the steps of getting a protection order, filing reports, keep journals of what's happening, like any safe way you can document this stuff. It's so important. And I'm glad you mentioned the paper trail, because that's something that a lot of these cases would probably, they'd have a lot more success if they could take those steps or find some way to document what's happening in a real way. I want to get us into just the very end here. I know we talked about your podcast in the beginning, but I know you mentioned a lot about relationships, and that's a key part of your podcast. What are some advice pieces that you would give to people who are within relationships, who are sitting here going, you know, we want to have a positive relationship. We don't want to be, you know, we're miles away from anything that's being discussed about on this show. But you know, sometimes, you know, I've noticed there's some things we do where we can veer into something that is manipulative, or we can veer into something where, you know, maybe unintentionally we're being abusive in the way that we're handling finances, or we're handling discussions about things, or we're raising our voice, or, you know, all those things that we might just do as instinct, or the way we were raised, all those kind of things. So for someone who's sitting here saying, I want to have a healthy relationship, I want this to look the way it should, what are some pieces of advice you've developed over the years, and maybe even from guests you've had on your show, that would be helpful?
I would say the first one is kind of the easiest in most aspects, and that is kind, honest communication. So I say it's easiest in most aspects because communication is fairly easy. It's the kind and honest part that a lot of us have trouble with.
Little tricky to do that.
Yes. And I don't mean in being honest, you know, I'm not saying everybody just wants to lie, but it's hard to tell somebody that you care about or somebody that you're in a relationship with, hey, when this happens, I feel this way, or, you know, when you yell, I feel really upset, and it brings me trauma, or it, you know, it brings me to a place mm-hmm. of fear. But it's important to do that, because here's a couple reasons. Like you mentioned, people may be doing it and not even realize it. It might be that they're not an abuser. They don't have an abusive personality. They're just communicating in a way that they didn't realize was hurtful to someone they care about. Mm-hmm. So it's really important to call out that behavior. I'll give an example of my own. My husband plays a lot of video games, far too many. But he sometimes yells, you know, he gets angry at whatever's happening. I don't know. I don't play video games, but whoever is trying to be killed in the game won't die or whatever. And he'll yell. And I started to realize that, like, it really bothered me. It really disturbed me. Like, I would get anxious. I would get upset. You know, I would leave the room. And so finally I said, you know what, I need to tell him, because he doesn't know this bothers me. Mm-hmm. So I did it from a non-attacking place. First off, I didn't say, you yell at these video games all the time. It's really stupid. I can't stand it. I hate it when you do that. You suck. Cause that's not gonna go well, most likely. But I said, first off, you know, I want to talk to you about something. Is now a good time? You want to make sure that the other person is in a space where they can hear what you're going to say, that they're ready to accept whatever information you're ready to give them. Because if they're not ready to accept, the conversation can be pointless. So then you want to kind and honestly communicate. So I said, you know, I know you get really into the games. Sometimes you yell though, and when that happens, I feel really anxious. Like it actually bothers me and I don't really understand why, but I just don't like it. And so again, you hear from the way I said that, I kind of put it on me, you know, yes, he's the action starter, but then I talk about how it makes me feel, what it does to me, kind of separate from him. And what happened was he said, oh, wow, like I didn't know that. I'm so sorry. And he yells way less now. But it's also a compromise, right? Because if he does yell, well, then I leave the room. So, I mean, there does have to be some compromise when you're dealing with not abusive behavior.
Yeah.
Don't compromise abusive behavior.
Right. Well, and there's context there too. Again, context is key to all this is, for example, it might not bother everybody. You know what I mean? And, and you know, for example, this is where I think it's important too for someone listening. Cause I think, you know, like you said, you take some of that on yourself. It's not, again, don't ever do that for abusive behavior with somebody. It's like, don't share the blame for why they do that. But for example, this situation you gave is perfect because getting amped up and yelling at a football game or at a video game or whatever that is, that's not inherently bad. You know, that's not an inherently awful thing. Like we get worked up about stuff, you know, there's things we get excited about. For your background, your context, hearing yelling is triggering memories of something that's happened that is extremely upsetting. It's going to bring out something very visceral in you. And it's important. And this is why there's not one golden thing for each relationship. You have to take into account that person's triggers and that person's, you know, things that are going to set them off in that way. And likewise, like it's important for someone who's in your position to understand too, which I think is great that you do, is like, he is not intentionally trying to set that off. Because the reality is people who come from a different context where that wasn't the day-to-day, they just don't think anything of it, you know? And so this is why I love the kind, honest communication. The last two are pretty easy. We can honestly say, oh, you suck. Don't do that. You know, like, but the kind thing in saying, okay, I don't understand. I think, you know, the easy thing for him to be would be like, don't make a big deal about it. It's just a video game. I'm just getting excited about it. But for him to take the time and say, I understand the situation I'm dealing with. I understand who I'm dealing with. I understand that they've had this experience and that experience. I can adjust what I'm doing to meet in the middle and say, how can I make this a more comfortable experience for you? Mm-hmm. And that just doesn't happen. I think what happens in a lot of relationships, and I've seen this happen in our relationship at times, is the times where we're butt heads the most is just when we haven't said, hey, why are you doing that? Or what's the reason that we're having this argument? Because usually it's a miscommunication. It's just not knowing that this person's upset because of this, or not knowing that this person reacts because this is how their family always did. So they just do it without a second thought. So I think context just keeps coming up, but it's so important for all these different situations. I think that's great advice. Kind of wrapping up here. I know that obviously we talked about the podcast. We want to push people there. Is there anywhere else you'd like for people to connect with you? I know you mentioned your advocacy group, Summit Advocates. Mm-hmm. If people want to get a hold of them just one more time, what's the best way to do that? And then if someone wants to follow your story and get to hear more from you, what's the best way for them to do that as well?
Awesome. Thank you. So I'm going to give you a couple different ways for Summit Advocates. The first one is our crisis hotline 24/7. It's 970-668-3906. You can also email us at info@summitadvocates.org. Now, if you're afraid that your devices are being monitored, you can send an email to summitbookstore@gmail.com and ask for a book about Annie. A-N-N-I-E. We will know that that is coded communication, and then we will communicate back with you in coded language about our bookstore until we can determine a safe way to talk with you. So if you are fearing that a device is monitored, just email us at that bookstore address, and we will communicate with you appropriately. As far as the podcast, we are on all social media networks at Strong Enough Pod. And then you can also reach us via email, strongenoughpod@gmail.com.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining me on the show. Love that we got to talk again. It's been a little while.
I know.
And really excited for all the stuff you're working on just personally and obviously with Summit Advocates as well. There's a lot of great work being done. But thank you so much for joining me on the show. And definitely everybody who's listening, head to the show notes, check out all the resources that we've mentioned. There's plenty of links in there, and be sure to check out the Strong Enough podcast. It's definitely well worth your time. But Claudia, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Eric. I appreciate you.
Thank you for listening to the Preacher Boys podcast. If you appreciated the content on the show, please leave a review on iTunes and don't forget to connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the handle @PreacherBoysDoc. Additional information can always be found on PreacherBoysDoc.com.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.